Welcome to Thoughts on Record, official podcast of the Ottawa Institute of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. Each episode, we explore topics of interest to clinicians and mental health consumers from a cognitive behavioral perspective. I'm your host, Dr. Pete Kelly.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Dr. Rebecca Schwarzlos is a neuroscientist at Washington University in St. Louis. Dr. Schwarzlos is the recipient of many accolades, including the Ruth Christensen National Research Service Award. Among her notable scientific accomplishments is the discovery and naming of an entire new brain region, the fusiform body area. She holds a PhD in neuroscience from MIT and has served as chief editor of the scholarly journal Trends in Cognitive Sciences. She lives in St. Louis with her family. Her new book, Brainscapes, was supported by a grant from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation Program in Public Understanding of Science and Technology. All right, Dr. Rebecca Schwarzlos, welcome to Thoughts on Record. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, thanks. Thanks for having me, Pete.
You are very welcome. Rebecca, I am so delighted to have you on the podcast today. I really, really enjoyed your book, Brainscapes, the warped, wondrous maps written in your brain and how they guide you. It was a great refresher for me on some of the more foundational neuroscience pieces that I haven't revisited in a little while. But, you know, it also prompted a lot of really clinically related questions around the implication of brain maps, which has really been a lot of fun for me to think through. And I'm so glad that you're here to be able to weigh in on some of these, I guess, sort of crazy thoughts I've been having over the past few weeks. But I guess just to begin, I'd like to get some of the foundational concepts out there. Rebecca, what is a brain map? And is there an example of a brain map that personifies the concept?
Yes. So a brain map is a spatial representation of something in the world, something having to do with your body or the space around you, what you see or what you hear, that is laid out across the surface or the inside tissues of your brain according to that layout of what's in the world. And so to give, I think, a quintessential example is the somatosensory cortex. So the touch, tactile, receptive cortex. And this is kind of a strip of cortex, one on each half of the side of the brain that represents the touch inputs coming in from the surfaces of your skin. And so what makes this a map is that the layout of this tissue and how it's representing information is laid out according to the layout of the body. And so to illustrate what I mean by that, we know that our body has a consistent layout, a topography, and, you know, the little toe is always next to the next little toe. And so in our brain, that organization is preserved. So the areas that are next to your physical body on your skin are represented right next to each other in the tissues of your brain. And as a result, you know, extrapolating beyond your two of your little toes to your whole body, what you get is this representation of your entire body in a way that is an actual literal map of the spaces of your body, but inside your brain. And we, in fact, use this map to process incoming information and to even imagine being touched. And so we have ways, and this map is very important in our conscious perception of touch. And likewise, we have maps for what we see, which are often mapped around where we're pointing our eyes. That's like the center of the map. And also what we hear, which is often mapped around the frequencies of sound that are coming into our ears.
So people may have seen a picture of what's called a homunculus, right? Which is sort of this sort of representation of the human body, but within the context of the brain. And a homunculus looks it's kind of a little bit funny looking. It's very disproportionate to the way that a conventional human being looks. Can you speak about why, you know, that image of the homunculus looks the way that it does?
Absolutely. Yes. So so you may have seen in Intro to Psychology or in other places, these sensory and the motor homunculus. There's usually two. One is reflecting specifically the representation of touch, which I described in that touch cortex, that somatosensory cortex. And it's warped. And that's part of the subtitle of my book. These maps are dramatically warped. And in this case, what we see is this, if you see the picture, it's a person, but it's got these giant lips and these enormous hands. And so it's like a caricature. It looks very bizarre, like an alien. And what it's reflecting is there imagining what a person would look like if the amount of space in your brain dedicated to representing touch on a surface were that relative size. And that's what makes the hands and the face so giant. So that is true in the somatosensory cortex. It's true in motor cortex, which controls our movements and also highly overrepresents our dexterous hands. But it's also true in many other maps, including in our visual cortex. So that when in the maps that represent what we see, we have this wildly overrepresented area for representing what we're looking at, where we're directing our eyes. And that's why we don't even notice it, because this is what vision's always been like for us, but we're actually, you know, really terrible at seeing out of the corner of our eye. And so we're constantly, every approximately 150 to 200 milliseconds, we're moving our eyes because we need to place everything of interest on that sweet spot for vision, which is magnified by our maps.
From reading the book, it looks like this style of mapping is conserved across many different organisms. So I guess from like an engineering perspective, if I can use that a little bit loosely, what have been the selection pressures or the evolutionary pressures that have forced brains into this way of mapping themselves or constructing themselves? What's the efficiency that's been selected for here?
Yes. So these are things we have to guess at. You know, we don't know for sure. We can't ask evolution, but there's a lot of evidence to suggest that what is driving this map, these maps, which, as you mentioned, are just conserved and really universal across brains in our, you know, on our planet, is space and energy. And really, you know, a lot of neuroscience comes down to this. You know, just our brain as magical as we tend to think of it as, is still a metabolic, you know, chunk of tissue, and it requires a lot of energy, and it requires space. And the problem is that as you put more neurons into a brain, and you know, each neuron is you know, a single brain cell that is going to be able to amplify how much information you can represent and process. So we think of like more neurons is better brains. But the problem is, if you have more neurons, you have to connect them to each other. And those connections, which I kind of refer to tongue in cheek as wires, they begin to just totally overwhelm the amount of space that is being taken up in the brain. And they also use up a great deal of energy. So what happens very quickly as you try to make a more complicated brain with more neurons is that you can have this, you know, crazy large brain, which is very hard to support. And it requires so much energy that an animal would starve. And that's a really stark, very high price tag. So, you know, it's just not evolutionarily supportable. So creatures, and even for small creatures who have much smaller brains than us, they have maps because it still benefits them. Because when you have maps, it allows you to pack a lot more neurons together and have them talk to each other in an efficient manner while taking up a lot less space and a lot less energy. And that's just a win-win. Whether you have a big brain or a small brain, you want to require fewer calories and be more likely to survive.
No, that's a really great explanation. And I just think it's so neat that there's this outside world, and we've constructed our own representation of that internally, but modified it in a way so that we can have an efficient way of moving through it. It's just so neat, you know, how the brain has managed to do this over the course of evolution, let's say.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's one of the things that I find so fascinating about this topic is that it's, you know, we kind of think of what we experience as this vertical representation of reality. But of course, what we're doing is catching, seizing upon and extrapolating, I mean, and pulling out all of the vital stuff for us as living creatures with our needs and our concerns. So some of that is shaped by evolution, as you said, and us having come from other creatures and from other humans who had to survive on planet Earth and therefore had to specialize. And some of it, as I write about in the book, also comes from our childhoods and our experiences early in life that help us kind of specialize in being prepared to live in the particular environment into which we've been born.
You've just summed up a couple of the lines of thinking that started to make my brain kind of explode in all good ways as I was reading the book. And I'm going to jump into some questions that have a bit of a clinical bent with respect to exploring the brain mapping context, if that's okay.
Sure, I will do my best.
Excellent. Okay, so I guess one question I had for you is, you know, things like chronic pain and somatic disturbances of various kinds are really common in trauma clients, especially those with adverse early life events. And I think you may have been alluding to this before, but I'd love to explore it just a little bit more. Are adverse early life events able to influence or modify brain maps of various kinds?
The answer is yes, that certainly adverse events or the exposure to certain types of, for example, painful stimuli can alter, early in life can alter the way in which one experiences some pain in the future. Some of that has been traced back to potential, suggestively, at least in humans, to some alterations in the actual maps that represent those sensations. There's more work to be done on how directly that links directly to maps versus, you know, there are other parts of the brain that do not operate by maps and operate by these kind of distributed codes. And so it can be a combination of those things. Most phenomena in the brain are a combination. Potentially it could be very specific. So there's one paper that came out some time ago about looking at tactile somatosensory cortex and women who had experienced either sexual or emotional abuse as children versus and as adults. And they specifically found that the region of the somatosensory cortex that represented the genitalia were thinned, that region of cortex was thinner, which kind of tends to show, can indicate kind of a stress sort of reduction effect in the women who had been sexually abused as children. You know, that's just one study. So I don't want people to come away thinking, but those kinds of factors, if they do, you know, if your early experiences do shape, do kind of in a long-term way change your brain maps, that can help to explain some of the somatic effects that you're describing. Like, for example, for women who have experienced or individuals who experience sexual trauma, they, you know, sometimes they have, difficulty with sexual sensation later in life. So there are some ways in which those may be avenues through which that effect could be perpetuated.
I guess sort of similarly, when we're undertaking what we call in our world an imaginal exposure with a client who is processing a past trauma. So for example, we'll have them go back and almost sort of narrate the script as though it's happening in real time of an assault they survived or similar. They'll often report very vivid what we call body memories, right? They can literally feel as though the event is rehappening to that, you know, whatever the respective part of their body is. Do we know what's going on here from a brain perspective, or perhaps even more specifically a brain mapping perspective? Like, how are brain maps activated in the context of memories, I guess, would be the overarching question.
Yes, that's a wonderful question. And so one thing that I talk about in the book is how mental imagery, which includes the kind of experience, the reinstantiation of a memory that you've had from the past where you feel it. Some people generate a kind of mental or a somatosensory image where they physically feel or kind of can see in their mind's eye what they saw or felt in the past. And when neuroscientists have looked at the brain, they've found that they can see this imagery playing out in the maps that actually process initial stimuli. So I had talked about the touch map that represents the body's surfaces. So if you're touched on your arm, then I would see activity reflecting that physical touch on the arm associated part of your touch map. But if you imagine being touched there, I can also, with my neuroimaging, see that you're imagining being touched in that place. The activity there is weaker, the response is weaker, but the same general pattern exists. So what is happening is that instead of that brain map reflecting what is happening on the outside from the periphery of your body, your memories are triggering a actual reinstantiation, a weaker reinstantiation of that experience in the same maps. And that's part of why, for many of us, memory and imagery can feel so real, because it's actually engaging the same structures of the brain that are involved in remembering, I mean, in experiencing them in the first place.
Well, it's so fascinating. I mean, I think I've seen studies where people have actually been able to increase, say, like their bench press or deadlift simply by visualizing them having, you know, lifting a certain amount of weight or a heavy weight. I know athletes use a lot of imagery rehearsal for downhill skiing, or I believe race car drivers do the same thing, something where there's a lot of, quick reaction time required. Is that all sort of tying into the same mechanism that you're describing?
It certainly is reflecting that same idea that imagery in engaging the same circuits and the same areas of the brain that are engaged for perception and for action, for movement, that can help to explain why people can reap performance benefits from imagery, and again why they can feel so, you know, a memory can be so upsetting when you bring it to mind and you relive it. Whereas if you don't actually have that kind of reinstantiation of it in a way that feels as if you're back in it, it might not be so disturbing, or it might not be so beneficial from a performance perspective if it's a good intended visualization.
Just a bit of a flyer question for you that came up for me while you were outlining these ideas, just maybe as a thought experiment. What about in a situation like virtual reality, where one sensory modality, or maybe two, maybe sort of vision and hearing at the very least, are getting sort of very specific inputs, but the rest of the map is maybe not getting tended to or stimulated in the way that it normally would. Do we know how the brain kind of knits all this disparate sort of information together? And again, you know, appreciating this might just be speculation, but I'm wondering how that would get encoded. And then in a memory, what would that look like? You know, if we could have the luxury of having that person in a brain scanner, like, does the brain fill in the gaps with respect to what that touch would feel like based on the only visual information that's coming in?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I haven't read much literature in terms of virtual reality, although some fascinating work has come out showing how, for example, you know, if you give your body, if you in your virtual reality have the body of a child or a body of somebody from a different race or gender, that actually can kind of change your short-term social. So there are some deep, profound things it can do. But, you know, what I do talk about in the book and have read more about is what happens when we, for example, watch a movie, which is specifically a, you know, visual and auditory input, but it's not, you know, an odor input. It's not a tactile input. And what you find is that even though you're sitting there in the dark or on your couch, just watching something, the different multimodal maps are getting activated in correspondence with what you're watching. So that if you see people shaking hands, even though you're not doing anything with your hands, you're just watching a movie, there is some activity in touch areas of hands and in motor areas of hands that reflects what you're watching happen, even though you're not doing it. So absolutely multimodally, this information is sort of echoing throughout the maps as you're experiencing it. So I would imagine some of that would certainly happen with virtual reality.
Now, is this occurring in so-called mirror neurons, or are we using our own sort of idiopathic maps to map the movements of other folks?
So some of these effects may be attributed to mirror neurons, and mirror neurons exist in some of these areas. I'm more referring to the neuroimaging literature, which is looking at a scale that is so large that you can't look at individual neurons and tell which kinds they are. But the kind of response that you're describing is kind of in parallel with the kind of reflections that have been attributed to mirror neurons by prior groups. So yes, on a whole, the similar kind of idea that what you see is resonating in your own brain and maybe part of your representation of that act or event.
Rebecca, are there what I've called maybe meta brain maps, that is patterns of activation across specific kind of first order brain maps, like the visual map, hearing, somatic, that are mapped or relate to a map to create a conscious experience, such as the experience of an emotion like anxiety or happiness, etc. So like, does the brain knit together activation from different maps into an even larger mapping that would help us to organize our perception of an experience in some way?
Yes, definitely. The brain does knit those responses together. And in fact, I talk in the book about how you have to think about all of these different parts of the brain and all these maps in context, that they're working together, and any one of them just cut out of the brain is just a dead piece of, you know, a dead piece of flesh. But there's also, you know, these, as I mentioned, these areas that are representing information with these distributed population codes, and they are different than maps. The neighboring neurons might represent really surprisingly different things. And they're much more flexible. They can represent, you know, not just this kind of thing, but also that kind of thing. And then maybe they can also learn a new thing tomorrow and represent that. So there are some very flexible areas, and they seem to work. They're crucial for learning, and they're also, but they seem to also work by, as you kind of mentioned, pulling in the maps. So the maps provide this, you know, on a kind of very high levels, the maps provide this more stable structure, this more kind of stable architecture within which the codes are able to then, you learn, change, and experience, and kind of, so I think that I'm not an expert in emotion, but just to say in general, I think the really high level things that we do in terms of, really complex thought and experience, and including consciousness itself, certainly involve this tying together of, maps and codes.
Yeah, it made me wonder if studying brain maps is maybe a really efficient road to this, to discovering what the seat of consciousness is, or having some sense of how we put it. I mean, I guess one little caveat is that animals also have brain maps, but we're not necessarily sure of their conscious experience. There's a sense of self that we seem to be able to impose over the experience of a brain map that, you know, may not be there in other organisms. What do you think about this idea of using brain maps as sort of a highway to get towards to answering the hard question of consciousness?
That's a great question. And I'm a little wary to try to answer it, because the hard question of consciousness.
You'll be right to be wary. Yes.
but certainly we know that these maps play a very important role in what we are conscious of, but they do it in kind of an intriguing way. For example, there's a lot of studies that have linked, a primary visual cortex, this kind of relatively early in the processing stream, very large visual map in our brain, to what we consciously perceive. And you can really kind of hash that out by poking a hole in it. Well, you know, you could have a bullet go through it, and then that person will no longer be consciously aware of that part of the visual field. Or you can stimulate it, and someone will see a light that's not there in that part of the visual field. So, you know, you can muck with it. And we've shown in many different ways that, you know, even with like visual illusions, the illusion you're conscious of is often reflected in the activity of that brain map, rather than what your eyes are actually receiving. However, we also know that if somebody is put under sedation, their V1 visual map is still processing information. So they don't have conscious experience, but their visual map is still active. And so we certainly know that the V1 map is very influential for what we consciously experience, and that it is not singularly capable of creating conscious experience. So again, that goes back to that idea that you have your maps, and then you have other areas that are tying everything together.
So brain maps are necessary, but not sufficient, let's say, for consciousness. There's some X factor that, you know, we just haven't been able to put together yet that, you know, provides that sort of sentient sense of ourselves.
Yes, definitely necessary, but not sufficient. And, you know, I mean, there are great people who are working even very specifically on that hard problem of consciousness and making a lot of inroads. But as far as, you know, my kind of grasp on it and where I am with thinking about brain maps is just to recognize that these brain maps are incredibly influential in that experience, and how they're warped and how they are, where their boundaries are, really shape what we perceive and what we can imagine. But knowing that there is much more, there must be much more to the story in terms of what is generating what we what we are experiencing, the fact that we do experience the way that we do.
Another kind of like flyer question for you. I've often heard that, you know, one of the sticky conundrums around AI technology is that a body is required in order to, you know, generate intelligence and consciousness. Is that something that you're familiar with, or do you have a sense of the rationale for that particular argument vis-a-vis your knowledge of brain maps?
Well, so I do touch on that in the book as well, because, you know, when I'm talking about meaning and how the brain maps are pulled in and how much of what actually things mean to us is rooted in our physical experiences with them. And so, you know, that puts up a challenge. So we know that AI does incredibly well at a lot of things, but one thing it struggles with is kind of having common sense conversations. And, you know, so why is that? Well, common sense is sort of based on meanings of shared experience in our physical world and all of the ways in which we approach the objects and the people around us and extract meaning from them. And that is not a representation that would be something we would have to teach to AI, right? We would have to give them lots of everyday experience examples in order for that it to learn, as we have, sort of, you know, that houses are things that you walk into and not under, or, you know, that all the basics. So I think the challenge is, and I think this is a really important point, because we tend to like to say humans are so smart. We're so much smarter than all other animals, and we're so much smarter than AI. And I don't think any of that's true. We are smart. I mean, we're obviously smart, but other animals are smart in different ways. And AI is smart in a lot of ways that we struggle to be, right? So what we really mean by intelligence is thinking like we do, is being able to see the world as we see it and communicate meaning through those channels. And I think that is why it's so hard for AI to be, you know, to have a real best friend that is AI rather a person, because that disembodied nature, I don't think it keeps it from being intelligent, but it keeps it from being intelligent in a way that you and I can chat with and extract real meaning from.
Wonderful. That's the best explanation of that concept I've heard to date. So thank you so much for laying that out. That's wonderful.
Thank you.
So another question I have for you is, you know, how do external factors, perhaps like culture or maybe even the specific environment, like, you know, living in a desert versus a jungle, how do those influence brain mapping? You know, does the V1 area of someone in one culture or area look potentially different from someone in another area? Genetics, all being equal, let's say, purely sort of the impact of culture and environment.
That is a wonderful question. And I can both, first of all, say, so first I want to say that we have very poor data on this. One thing about neuroscience that we as a field really need to work on, and there are a lot of practical challenges to it, is moving outside of studying Western cultures, and specifically Americans and Europeans from Western Europe. And really, we don't have a lot of neuroimaging data from many, many parts of the world that that we should be, so that we can ask these questions more effectively. And that's particularly problematic because, you know, we tend to say human brain works like this. And I think certainly we have the human brain across cultures, it has the same structure and it works according to the same principles. But we know that culture is so integral to the early experiences that we have and the kinds of information that are essential to us. And so it's a vital question to be answered. And based on the animal literature, where people can experimentally change the kind of experiences that early animals have, we have every reason to think that some aspects of culture do create subtle changes in brain maps, but we haven't shown that. I do talk in the book about specifically with the sense of smell, which we tend to discount as something we as humans are pretty terrible at, you know, that there may be a cultural factor there, because, you know, these days, if you go to the grocery store and pick up your food and it's got an expiration date and we don't really need to use smell that much for our survival. And so that may be something, stuff that we actually have very good sense of smell, but we don't have the right language to talk about it. And we don't kind of are very bad at naming it. And in other cultures where like hunter-gatherer cultures where smell becomes more integral to finding the food that you're going to eat, they have much richer vocabulary and a much better, more consistent ability to identify specific odors. And it doesn't, you know, it, so I think, you know, if there's something that you need in your culture to survive, absolutely there's reason to think that your attention, your experiences will cultivate representations of those things that will help you later in life. And that can certainly happen in your brain maps.
I had a similar thought around the visual system, right? Like if you look at the average North American, you know, a lot of their day is attending to visual stimuli that are say within a 3 to 10 foot sort of radius around them, right? Like a screen or someone in the same room, where I could imagine someone perhaps in a more traditional society, perhaps with a hunter-gatherer kind of element, maybe scanning the horizon, you know, looking out over a mountain range or a savanna or a field or, you know, whatever the environment happens to be, it doesn't matter. And it strikes me as that would be, it'd be so interesting to look at how the maps are sort of optimized across those two different selection pressures as far as the environment goes. I mean, maybe there's no answer to that for the moment, but these are things that I wonder about as I read your book.
Yeah. We don't have an answer for it. What I would say is that I think the biggest impact would be whether the children are having different experiences. And I think newborn babies tend to have more similar experiences across cultures than adults do. And therefore, you know, the things that are integrally shaping the map in the most dramatic fashion are going to have a lot of universals. But they might also have differences. And, you know, the exposures that you have, for example, you know, I think about this today with masks, like how many faces you're seeing, you know, how many, you know, that can vary between cultures and between individuals. And when you're in and out of a pandemic and all of those things can, you know, those are things that's all grit for training your brain.
This question will build on this a little bit. I'm really interested in how plastic brain mapping can be in practical terms. And I think, you know, the obvious answer with the brain is the younger the brain that you're dealing with, the more plasticity there is. You know, if there's a brain injury of some kind, again, particularly early in life, can the V1 area, you know, jump in for something that's being done in the temporal lobe or vice versa? Are there any areas that can't seem to reorganize, that are more rigid in their plasticity and very, very functionally sort of bound to their particular location in the brain?
That's a wonderful question. So yes, we have plasticity throughout life, including in our maps, that our maps can adjust and change and kind of modify how they're warped exactly through our experience. But by far in early childhood, that is when you have the most plasticity, the most capacity to change. And so, yes, if you have, if an adult has a stroke, as we know, you know, it can be devastating at first, and then hopefully they're able to make, depending on where the damage is, hopefully they're able to make some improvements and regain some quality of life. And so, you know, and that some of that is building upon the plasticity that remains in their brain as adults. But for, you know, for children, children can have strokes, and newborn babies can have strokes, and they tend, you know, it still can be very impairing for them, but they tend to be able to overcome much larger disruptions to their brains and regain much more function. And that's because they are capable at that point in time, especially very early infancy, to totally basically reorganize their brains. And I do tell the story in the book about, you know, one child who's one hemisphere of her brain just failed to develop. And she, amazingly, she was born almost, I mean, she was pretty normal. She had a little bit of motor impairment, but she was able to, on the side of her body that had lost, representation in the brain. But she, even with vision, which in theory, she should have not been able to see half of the visual field. But she actually kind of, her brain had developed a new organization for her visual map. So even though it was only in one hemisphere, she could squeeze in representation from both sides of her visual field. And there have been studies with animals that show that if you reroute a newborn animal's auditory inputs to visual cortex or vice versa, you can start to get representations in that cortex of the different modality. So like these neurons at this stage are just incredibly able to adapt. And that's also why if you're born blind, like if you're born and you're congenitally blind, you can take your visual cortex and that would normally be used for vision and really radically redistrict it and use it for things. You know, there are areas in visual cortex in people who are congenitally blind that seem to be really important for syntactic processing and, you know, linguistics. So it's amazing what can be done early in life. And so, yes, there is this incredible sort of pluripotency, this incredible sort of ability to be anything at that stage. And then we lose some of that, a lot of it over time. And as I try to say, I think it's a good thing usually that we lose it because it allows us to specialize and be well adapted for life in the particular environment with the particular inputs that we have. So it is a good thing, but it certainly is a dramatic change from infancy.
That's so fascinating, eh?
Yeah, I think it really is. And I feel like the more that I learned about this, the more I felt differently about, you know, my kids and the babies that I'd see in a stroller on the street, just thinking about that age where you do so little, but you're learning so much and you have this incredible power to sort of adapt to the environment and the inputs that you have. It just really gives you a new found appreciation for infancy.
Absolutely. Yeah. It doesn't look like there's a ton going on, but I mean, it's like undertaking the job of efficiently constructing reality.
You know, like, exactly.
That's all.
Exactly. And, you know, as I point out later in the book, you know, many aspects of the brain sort of stay the same from infancy throughout our lives. So that brain that we have constructed from a time before we can remember is, you know, in many ways, the brain that we're living with. We're living with a baby brain, and we've managed in these many amazing ways, some of which I talk about in the book, managed to eke a lot of adult capacities out of these brains. I really like turning that idea on its head and saying, instead of us just, you know, babies are just pre-adults, they're just on their way, you know, they're just, the point of babies is to become adults. Really, what we are is like big babies that have managed to do so much more with our little baby stuff. And I like to think about it that way because I think it helps explain some of the things that we struggle with on an everyday basis, you know, and some of the things that we ask our human adult mind to do. And it's hard. You know, what are the things that are hard often are the things that we didn't have to be prepared to do when we were infants.
Oh yeah, you're making a great case for self-compassion, right? I mean, how many people you know, are going through a divorce for the first time or raising children for the first time or getting laid off for the first time, right? These are not experiences that we get a dress rehearsal for. You're just thrown in with your sort of more rigid adult brain. It can be very hard to adapt.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think giving yourself, so forgiving yourself and accepting yourself from where you are and knowing that these things should by all rights be hard and it's okay. I think that's a really good kind of emotional step for being able to then face new challenges. And to also kind of recognize the ways in which we can use tools that kind of allow us to make the most of our brains. And in terms of, you know, our social relationships, which provide structure and support and really are, and you know, our ability to, you know, rely on machines and calculations and other things to take care of our list, to write our notes to ourselves so we don't forget, and all of these things that we can do that kind of offload some of our mental requirements, and they can help us to adapt well to the challenges of being an adult.
What about people who are exceptional in some specific way, like, you know, like a pro athlete or a sommelier who can pick out like 30 different sort of, you know, scents or flavors within a wine, or, you know, some other sort of ability that is, you know, sort of fourth standard deviation out from the mean? From a brain mapping perspective, how can we understand those folks if the answer is known?
It's It's only known. I mean, it's known in certain circumstances. So it's generally not known. But what I can say is, I have an example from musicians. So in the case of learning to play music, that they're, especially if you start training an instrument very early, you see these more dramatic changes in your motor maps that reflect that training, and that stays with you later in life. And even people who learn, you know, later in childhood, maybe when they're 10 rather than when they're 5, don't see that. You don't see that big change in their representation. And that's not a better or a worse thing. It's just the ways in which our maps are shaped by those, the early training or kind of expertise that we receive. But there's every reason to think that to a lesser degree, we do continue to, as we have sensory experiences, as we perform motor acts, that we are continuing to, on a smaller scale, refine and sort of personalize our maps to help us do more with our brains.
Are some people, you know, sort of mapping geniuses in a way, in terms of the resolution or the way that their map is able to sort of, you know, construct reality or spatial awareness or anything like that? Or am I missing the point? Is it more about the association? Is that too simplistic a take on it?
It's not too simplistic a take. And actually, you know, there has been a little work looking at specific brain maps and individual differences between them. So most, a lot of neuroscience and neuroimaging with humans has kind of sought to understand the universals. So average across a bunch of brains and what do you see? But there have been efforts to look at the individual variation. And it's shown that, that differences in exactly how your brain maps are warped do seem to affect your ability to perceive fine detail. And in the case of with different parts of your body or with, you know, with your different parts of your retina for vision. And that it can also affect your performance on things like a visual search task or a visual memory task. So there may be ways in which each of us is born, you know, each of our brains, these major maps are all there in you and in me, and they're very similar, but they can be slightly different. And each of our maps in its own slight differences that can actually influence some of our naturally, what we're naturally good at or naturally struggle with. Now, what I wouldn't want to say is that one person might be born with like the best maps, because, you know, no one's looked at this, and I would love to, you know, someday dig into it, but you know, the idea that because it's a zero sum game, we have to keep our brains moderately sized and not too hungry. You know, if we're going to give more real estate to processing a certain part of visual cortex, of visual information in one part of our brain, we might have to lose something else, some specialization in another part of our brain. Right. So, you know, it's part of all of that goes back to that idea of all of us having our strengths and weaknesses, but it gives one of the kind of a physical kind of neural instantiation for some of the reasons that we may have those strengths and weaknesses.
No, really appreciate that answer. I have a couple of fun speculative questions lined up for you, if that's okay. You know, just I was fascinated with bats as a kid, so I really appreciated the part on bats in the book that, you know, it was just so interesting to me. Just as a bat, you know, has the ability to echolocate via access to a specific kind of brain mapping, and of course they have the appropriate sensory detecting complement to that as well. You know, with the right modification, could brain mapping in a human be a conduit for things like paranormal experiences, right? Where we can map that which is unseen or unfelt for most, but perhaps, you know, if somebody has a different ability to map some aspect of reality, is that perhaps one mechanism by which that phenomenon, if it is real, could come about?
You know, I would say this. So what we are able to process, so we know, for example, that that there are that many, many creatures can process information that we can't. And that includes, you know, sound frequencies that are far beyond our ability to hear, and ultraviolet light that we can't see, but bring butterflies to their flowers. And so, you know, I think if a baby were to be born with radically different eyeballs, you know, or radically different cochlea that could give them access to these other frequencies of light or of sound, then, you know, and that is being sent into the brain, you'd have every reason to expect that they would, that brain would do something with that information as long as it was of use to their survival or helpful. So, you know, I think the limiting factor in many ways is the experience. And since we have, to my knowledge, we don't have people born with eyes that are dramatically different in their capacity to, you know, so, but I think it does raise that idea that certainly in terms of brain computer interfaces. So, you know, we're limited by our physical peripheral bodies and its capacities, which are highly evolutionarily determined. And so that kind of constrains what the brain is going to be able to process, because that's what we're feeding into it. But, you know, in theory, if you had some sort of detector that, you know, some machine that was detecting something else, another frequency of sound or light, or, you know, you had a new body part with tactile inputs on it, and you plugged it into the very early baby brain, again, every reason to believe, I mean, this has obviously not been done in humans and never should be, but every reason to believe that that baby brain would learn how to process that information.
See, where this gets really interesting for me is if consciousness happens to not be localized within the brain, like if it's more of a field phenomenon. And I appreciate I'm getting like sort of way out there, and I won't take it any further than that. But the idea, if the brain is sort of picking up consciousness as a field, and certain people have different maps for that, it gets very interesting very quickly. Same with, you know, when folks take psychedelics, they can often have very, you know, pronounced perturbations in consciousness. And how is that happening? You know, is there mapping overlay? Anyway, I'll leave it at that for now. But I think there's a lot more, I think, to discover about how the brain interfaces with the environment.
That's interesting. So from my perspective, I do feel that we have enough amazing information bouncing around in that brain to create the consciousness based on what has come in from the environment that we've detected. But I definitely hear you in terms of the fact that there is a lot more information that we probably are receiving and maybe not conscious of that is shaping our experience. I think especially in terms of our, in neuroscience, there's a new awareness of the degree to which interoception, or our awareness of our own bodies and the feelings within them and our postures, is also very integral to how we experience the world.
Oh, for sure. I mean, this is Lisa Feldman Barrett's model of emotions, right? Where the interoception is the foundational unit of building up affect. And then subsequently the brain interprets those two together to come up with what emotion that we're experiencing. And I really like the way you put it. I think you put it much more elegantly than I did, that, you know, there's so much information coming in, of which we just through, you know, a necessity, we only detect a certain amount of it, because otherwise we'd be overwhelmed. Like, let's look at electromagnetic energy, for instance, right? We limit it down to the visual spectrum. Imagine we had to see infrared and ultraviolet and x-ray and all this kind of stuff, right? It might just be too much.
Well, and, you know, so it might be too much kind of emotionally, but actually getting back to that idea of the brain having to be small and compact and efficient, it would be way too much, because we would have to devote all this extra space to processing infrared things that we saw and then to making sense of them. And so we would be adding on more brain stuff that we don't need. So it would be a terrible, terrible choice for us. But, you know, it's a great choice for rattlesnakes, because they actually are going to use that infrared to find, you know, a little baby squirrel's nest in the middle of the night, and that's their lunch. So, right, exactly. So we have to pick and choose that's what our brains do for us, thankfully. And that's one of the things that I love about thinking about brain maps, is because it's this literal, you know, illustration in our brains of what matters for us, for our survival. And, I love that, you know, that the concreteness of it, and the physicality of that.
Well, you've set up my last fun question almost perfectly. In fact, perfectly, I would say. So, you know, are there maps of meaning within the brain? You know, things like morality, rules of the game, even sort of like, you know, Jungian archetypes, the collective unconscious, things like that. Because there is pretty good data in psychology that while there's many ways to be a human, there's not an infinite number of ways. There does seem to be some rules of the game. Like, for instance, like even little rats have rules about how they play with one another. And if a certain ratio of winning to losing is not adhered to, the other rat will walk away, right? And sort of out of a sense of unfairness. And that's like anthropomorphizing to the max, but I think you get what I mean. So, you know, how much of a blank slate are we from this perspective? How much mapping infrastructure comes preloaded versus how much is, again, from a distinctly human perspective versus how much are we, you know, creating from the environment? I know it's like, that is a massive question, probably its own podcast, but, and it may not even map onto brain mapping. I suspect it may not in the way that, you know, you've written about it, but I'd be just so curious to get your take on this. Like how predisposed are we? And is that baked into our central nervous system? It's like, you know, like try violating your conscience for a month and see how that goes. Like it just won't work, right? Like there's corrective sort of, you know, information built into the system. Is our brain cross-referencing how we act or think relative to a map of the ideal of how we should be conducting ourselves?
So at that very high level of how we conduct ourselves, I do not think we are going to find a map for that. So we do continue to find maps in the brain. So it's not as though we know what all of the maps are. And, you know, there are some ways in which you kind of have maps that relate to sort of good and bad behavior or good and bad outcomes or that are relevant for social interaction. But I think that when you get to those high level questions, a lot of that is culture, but also, you know, you'd be looking more to those distributed neural codes more than those brain maps. So the brain maps are really more kind of concrete. They're more allowing us this interaction with our environment and sort of translating the two. Because you're not as interested with whether the maps are nature versus nurture, right? You're sort of more interested with whether that high level. So that is that I would not attribute that to a map. I would say though that some of the commonalities that we have as human beings across individuals and across cultures is some of that is, you know, has been a lot of that has been attributed to evolution, and I think I'm sure some of that is attributable to evolution purely in terms of how our brain it wires up even, you know, prenatally. But I think we also discount the ways in which the infant is shaped by early life and by the universalities of that early life, as we talked about, even across cultures, you know, that we all feel hunger and we all rely at that early age on a caregiver and their warmth and the milk. And, you know, the things, the basics that of survival at that point in time are so universal. And it is upon that foundation, kind of both behaviorally, experientially, and neurally, that we build all the more complicated things. So I think that some of the universalities that we see across individuals in terms of what it means to be human and what it means to kind of interact with others could be shaped by very early perceptual experiences.
Really appreciate your answer on that, Rebecca. Again, I know that was sort of like a giant question, but I really appreciate all the nuance that you brought in there. It was wonderful. Rebecca, one last question for you. You know, from your lens, what's the most important takeaway for clinicians from a brain mapping perspective?
That's a really good question. And I you know, one thing that I think to myself when I wrote the book that I kind of share in the introduction that it's not a how-to book because I don't think that I don't want people to come away feeling like this is going to make me better at X or Y. What it sort of does is help you understand why these things that we already know, like practice makes you better, or, you know, early life, you know, why babies are adaptable and why, you know, why you look where you need to see. And so these ways in which what we do, why we do it, I think is really kind of powerful. So I would not presume to tell a clinician any advice at all, other than to say that I think sometimes it plugging your patient into an awareness of why, for example, they on a neural level, why they might be, you know, why memories are can be upsetting when you bring them to mind, and that they're occupying that same neural architecture. That can give them it can help, I think, a patient mechanistically, like just wrap their head around it, and also maybe therefore take some kind of extra level of control, that if you understand the phenomena, then that can be empowering.
Absolutely. I love that. I have a background in neuroscience, and I do like to take clients under the hood as much as possible to help them understand why they're experiencing things the way they are and why we're doing the intervention in the way that we are. So that really resonates what you've said. Rebecca, if people want to find out more about you, your work, where can they find you?
Well, I have a couple of websites. I have www.rebeccaschwartzlos.com. And for those who are wary of spelling my last name, you can also find me at www.gardenofthemind.com. And I'm on Twitter at GoTheMind, is GoTheMind. And I love to hear from people, and I'm excited to be sharing the story of brain maps and with everyone.
Wonderful. Well, the book is Brainscapes, The Warped, Wondrous Maps Written in Your Brain and How They Guide You. Really, really interesting read. I recommend everybody pick it up. And Rebecca, it's available through all major places where books are found.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can find it at your local bookstore. You can find it online at any place where books are sold.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time and expertise today. It was a really fun conversation, and I really enjoyed in particular you fielding some of my more out there questions, but that's what makes the podcast so much fun.
Yeah, it was a blast. Thank you so much, Pete. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much. Take good care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, I really hope that you enjoyed the podcast as much as I did. If you found value in the show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. And now for the mandatory disclaimer. This podcast represents the opinions of Dr. Kelly and that of his guests. Content of the podcast should not be taken as psychological advice and is for general information only. Please consult your mental health professional for any specific questions around your psychological health. In no way does listening to our content establish a psychologist-client relationship. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors. All people, places, and scenarios mentioned in the podcast have been changed to protect patient confidentiality. Finally, this podcast should not be used in any legal capacity whatsoever, including but not limited to establishing a standard of care in a legal sense or as a basis for expert witness testimony. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions made on the podcast.